You're listening to the Digital Forensics Files podcast with your host, Tyler Hatch from DFI Forensics.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Forensics Files podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Hatch from DFI Forensics. Today, I'm happy to welcome to the podcast Michael Argast from Cobalt Security in Vancouver. Michael, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tyler. Really looking forward to it.
Likewise. So I just want to take you back. You've got quite a rich history in the information security scene in Vancouver. Can you take us back to where it all began and how you got into it?
That's a very polite way of saying gray hair. So yeah, I started in information security working for a company called ActiveState, which is a local Vancouver software open source firm. And I'd worked primarily to that in telecom and internet connectivity and that kind of stuff. I joined ActiveState for kind of two primary reasons. One was I was running my own Linux server in my basement and I was seeing spam become a problem. And ActiveState had a solution at the time called PearlMX, which was basically a spam assassin based spam filtering tool. So I said, hey, this is a real problem and everybody's going to have to deal with it. So that was kind of interesting to me at the time.
Yeah.
The other thing about ActiveState that was really compelling was the fact that, you know, there weren't really a lot of open source commercialization companies out there. Like Red Hat was still kind of an early thing and all that kind of stuff. It's like, how do you do that? How do you make open source and commercial stuff work?
Right.
About a year and a half after I started with ActiveState, I started as a sales engineer there and then quickly took on a team. We were growing incredibly fast. Everybody needed spam filtering.
Yeah. What time frame are we talking about? What year?
That would be around 2002, I think.
Okay.
Around there.
Right.
And anyway, so ActiveState was bought by a company called Sophos out of the UK, yeah. Large endpoint security company, focused primarily on small and mid-sized companies. I went from being the sales engineering manager in Vancouver to running global sales engineering worldwide for Sophos, grew that to a team of about 120 people in 17 countries. So my initial background in security comes from a technologist perspective, right?
Right.
So malware, spam filtering, gateway protection, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
After a number of years running a global team at Sophos, had a second kid, decided I wanted to travel less, came to work for TELUS, ran a variety of different security teams within TELUS, customer facing. And so at this point in my career, because I'm a technology geek kind of person,
likewise,
you know, I'm fairly deep on the technology side of things, but I've run consulting teams and operations teams and all these sorts of different groups. I'm kind of very broad in security, and I'm not an inch deep, I'm more like a foot deep.
Right.
And so most of my actual kind of functions in the last, you know, decade or so have been leadership roles.
Right.
But, you know, I'm still kind of a hands-on geek when it comes to it.
Well, that's a good blend for sure. So have you always been interested in technology? Like as you
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, kind of, you know, early BBS user at home and built my a first computer with my dad when I was 7 with soldering iron, all this kind of heat kit, and won a computer science programming contest when I was 7 as well. And then actually kind of lost interest in computer science because I had started so young and became much more interested in like engineering, robotics and other stuff. And then kind of pivoted into networking and the internet just as that boom was starting to happen.
Right.
But security is like, it's a lifelong passion for me at this point.
Absolutely, yeah. But what a great base for you in terms of seeing technology develop, being hands-on and building it, and those foundational skills like Linux back in the day and coding and all that kind of stuff that I assume you were...
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's traditionally where a lot of people who are kind of security professionals at this point in their career who've been doing it for a decade or more come from.
Right.
So they come from some sort of networking sysadmin background traditionally. And one of the things that I'm actually telling people who are entering the field for the first time is, you know, technology has changed dramatically. And one of the big changes is, you know, infrastructure is code. It's all in the cloud. You need to think about security less from a firewall, router, port and protocol perspective and much more from a code perspective.
Right.
And so AppSec and code is much more important than understanding how to configure a firewall rule.
Right.
And that's just because the whole nature of how businesses build their technology stack has changed.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I'm telling people, like, yes, you want to understand the OSI layer and you want to understand networking and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, pick up Python, learn some programming languages, go and play in AWS cloud, do these things, because that's where, you know, people's data infrastructure is today. And so the models that you use to protect those things is dramatically different than, you know, I've got a bunch of servers in a data closet.
100%. Now, the interesting thing when I hear you talk about that, you're absolutely correct. I agree with everything you just said. The problem is in reaching the people who need to hear that message, they're just getting caught up on technology and the problems from 10 years ago or 5 years ago. So now everything's changed from that. And now we have to communicate all the risks and responsibilities of business owners and executives into the present state.
Yeah,
it's very challenging.
There's not kind of one market out there. Right. And so obviously you and I are sitting in Vancouver, and I like to say that on the scheme of, you know, technology adoption and advancement and security maturity and all this kind of stuff, Canada tends to be a couple years behind the States, for example. We're just, you know, we're like, hey, we're nice Canadians, we're polite, nobody really wants to attack us. We tend to be a little bit slower to adopt best practices, whether that's cloud technologies or security protocols and practices and stuff like that.
Right.
And so, but within a given community, there's lots of different levels of maturity and development, right? Mm-hmm. So like in Vancouver, for example, there's a ton of tech companies that are very cloud focused. And then you have traditional old school companies that, you know, have an Exchange server and a, you know, and a wiring closet and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, you run into organizations that are all different levels of maturity and have to be able to help them to recognize where they are and how to get there and all that kind of stuff. And that's part of the fun.
It is actually aspect. I agree. It is part of the fun. So you, when you advanced from the telecom security world, am I mistaken that you retired actually briefly?
Yeah,
or I tried. It didn't stay very well.
I never intended to come completely fully retire because although I have gray hair, I'm still fairly young. And
he doesn't have gray hair, by the way. You don't have gray hair.
It's the advantage of light brown.
I have more gray hair in my beard than you do on your head.
Well, that's because I don't grow a beard. And because if I grow a beard, it's way more gray than yours. Anyway, I had done very well at Sophos and at Telus and through some personal investments and semi-retired. I never got out of the game because, you know, I was 44 when I kind of pulled the plug and knew that I wanted to do a little bit of consulting and stuff like that. And sort of accidentally built a lifestyle business, which you know as Sky Northern Security Alliance, which is a referral network for independent security consultants. I've since folded that into Cobalt. And so that was kind of my semi-retirement gig. And, you know, actually kind of origin story of Cobalt was I had spent 2 months on a beach in Thailand with my family, very relaxed, getting massages every other day and all this kind of stuff. Came back actually itchy to do a bit of work. And that's when my co-founders got to me and said, hey, we want to do this startup thing. Do you want to do it with us? And so I am fully not retired anymore.
No, you are not.
You know,
no.
Startup life is busy crazy, but I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, that's great. You're doing a really good job too. So let's talk about Cobalt now, your present operation. You founded Cobalt Security about a year ago.
Yep, November 2019. Yeah.
Awesome. Congratulations. It's really doing well. Talk to us about what exactly Cobalt is and what the model is and who its clients are.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I first started Cobalt, you know, a lot of my career has been focused on large enterprise. And that's where most people in cybersecurity tend to focus because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've sold to Fortune 50 companies all over the world, you know, names that I probably shouldn't mention here, but organizations with hundreds of thousands of employees, three-letter agencies, all this kind of stuff, working with the biggest of the big, and smaller organizations all the way down. And my personal belief is everybody needs great security. And in the small and mid-sized organizations, they do not have the internal resources necessary to address security effectively. And at the same time, they have a lot of the complexity of a large organization. So if you look at a 100-person software company, as an example, you know, they're going to have maybe a DevOps team, they're going to have sales, marketing, product management, all these different kind of functions, and they'll probably have two or three people who are IT, and if they're lucky, one person who's dedicated to security or a person who's doing it off the side of the desk. So when we first started off Cobalt, we decided to focus on what's kind of a hard but scalable solution problem in the small and mid-market, which was security monitoring, right? Who watches all the stuff? Who keeps an eye on the blinky lights, is aware of what's going on, and can watch for incidents and then bring them to the team when something's actually happening, right? A lot of our initial focus was on B2B SaaS companies because from a customer acquisition and adoption perspective, they're very technologically savvy. So give me your event data is a 30-minute conversation rather than my IT guy comes every other week. So, you know, fast onboarding. But we've scaled onto, you know, more traditional businesses and stuff like that since. So security monitoring is a solution where we have a cloud-based stack and we ingest event data from a bunch of different customers. We have canned use cases and we build them for individual customers. And then we can alert them when there's signs of risk or issues and help them kind of work their way through those. That was kind of where we started. And since then, we've expanded to much more kind of security program as a service. So helping people do gap assessments, helping people do, you know, working with people like yourselves to build incident retainer plans, working to help them programmatically enhance their entire security program and build it forward. And that's kind of another thing about me and my passion is, like, I recognize walking in the door, nobody is perfect in security. Most of us have strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And it's not about, like, you know, a lot of people are kind of security absolutists. Everything's got to be locked down to the nth degree and all this kind of stuff. I'm much more a security pragmatist. It's like, mm-hmm. how do we help your business succeed?
Yeah.
And what is the role of security in helping your business succeed?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I'm a much stronger believer in, let's take a ratchet-based, you know, gradually improving approach so that a year from now, your security program is significantly better than it was when you started.
Right.
And so that's kind of a lot more of our focus. And even when we do security monitoring, a lot of it isn't detect an incident, it's detect risk. Oh, yeah. By the way, you accidentally made an S3 bucket public. Did you intend to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you wanted to turn down that control.
Yeah.
We had a customer we were talking to who had accidentally synced their Salesforce data into their box and the box setting was public, right?
And
those sorts of things happen all the time in an organization because people are doing stuff.
Right.
And it creates downstream risk. And if you can detect it when it's happening, then you can reduce the risk and eliminate the opportunity for a breach to occur in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're talking about that, I'm actually reminded of a real world example that has nothing to do with computers or data. But the way I relate to it is that there's opportunities that people will seize on immediately.
Yeah.
The people are searching and they're trying to prey on those kind of opportunities all the time that we don't even know about.
Yeah.
And the example that I'm thinking of is my next door neighbor crashed into his garage door last week and it was damaged. And basically within the 12 hours that the bottom of his garage door was bent, somebody slipped in.
Yeah.
He didn't lock his garage door and they went into his house and stole his MacBook. And we were shocked that in our neighborhood, that somebody took advantage of that opportunity so rapidly.
Yes.
I mean, it was just shocking. And that's very much like security.
Yeah.
You make a mistake, like you make a bucket public, somebody's going to take advantage of that really quickly. So to have it identified as a risk and be able to give your clients the opportunity to correct it immediately is really valuable.
Yeah, and I mean, a classic example is there are specifically tools out there that people use all the time to scan for open public S3 buckets.
Mm-hmm.
There's Shodan, all these tools that look for vulnerabilities. And so I have this little shorthand saying that I say, which is, you know, if your systems are soft, attackers will attack your systems because it's easy and they can automate that attack. So they can do it at scale.
Sure,
right. And so if you've got unpatched vulnerabilities, Heartbleed, all these sorts of different things, then attackers will go after you because it's easy that way.
Right.
If your systems are hard, if you've done the right things to patch and secure your systems, mm-hmm. then they're going to go after your people because people are soft.
Yes.
Right. So,
absolutely.
You know, the first step is actually making sure that those basic hardening of your systems that are externally facing, is done.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, you know, unfortunately, the other problem is the attackers have scaled phishing and social attacks to the point where they go after everybody. And
mm-hmm.
so the people soft thing is a problem of scale as well.
Right.
My favorite personal example of this is, you know, we've seen phishing attacks against my daughter's elementary school PAC. It's a school with 100 people and an annual budget of $20,000. There's targeted phishing accounts where they scraped the name of the treasurer and the PAC chair and had targeted emails and all this kind of stuff. It's like,
mm-hmm.
if they're hitting that organization, imagine how much they're going after, you know, large public organizations and everything else. It's a scale problem.
Absolutely, yeah. It's incredible. Yeah, it's a really good example, actually. What do you think it's going to take to get to the point where we're not just defending against attacks, but actually trying to do something about the problem as a whole? Like, how do you think that's a 20-year problem that we're not quite ready to tackle, or a 50-year problem?
I think there are opportunities in different places, right? And so probably a couple of my favorite examples of this are end-to-end encryption, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so end-to-end encryption has become a default norm in most places and is effectively dramatically reducing the risk of man-in-the-middle type of attacks,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, Apple rolled it out with iMessage, it's in Signal, it's in WeChat, and there's all these different sorts of apps.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have backdoors, some of them don't, but generally speaking, you know, when you're messaging people via messaging software, you're end-to-end encrypted, and it's hard for an interceptor to receive those messages.
Right.
One of my favorite personal examples of this is, you know, 5 years ago, 6-7 years ago, the proportion of HTTP traffic across the internet that was encrypted was like 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Then Let's Encrypt came out, fantastic service, free certificates for everyone,
right?
And today it's like closer to 90%, right?
Yeah.
And so there are opportunities within our industry to dramatically raise the bar at scale, and
mm-hmm.
those are exciting, right?
Yeah,
and they will have impacts on security. I think the fundamental problem, though, is you know, we have an active adversary. It's not like building a network. You build a network, it does what it's designed to do. You know, that's great, mm-hmm. right? With security, you have an active adversary who's always going to be trying to find new ways to get into your infrastructure and attack your valuable assets.
Right.
And so the fundamental challenge that we have with the active adversaries is international geopolitics and the fact that they exist beyond prosecutable borders and all this kind of stuff. And that's a harder problem to solve, especially with Eastern Europe and Russia and China and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's even a 20-year problem. I think that's a much longer-term societal issue that we're going to have to figure out how to resolve. And so we actually have to address the core security problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like if somebody invades your country, then you're going to fight them back. But mm-hmm. like if somebody attacks you with cyber warfare, then, you know, you can't go across, you know, the world and, you know, infiltrate Eastern Europe in order to attack those people, right?
Right.
And so there's kind of a asymmetric aspect to that.
100%, yeah. One of the things that frustrates me is the ability that as a society we want to be able to use the internet anonymously and not have people pinpoint us and target us for ads and communications and all that kind of stuff. But that same concept allows people to be anonymous through just an IP address that might be on another side of the world, which is easy to disguise.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to take huge changes as a society and as a world and as governments to cooperate to actually get people. And we're not even trying to catch the people. Let's make that clear. We're just actually trying to stop the problem from occurring.
Yeah.
I don't think there's really any efforts made globally to actually stop the people and identify who
they
are. Yeah.
So, even though I am a security expert, you're talking about kind of... There's always these trade-offs between privacy and anonymity and security.
Right.
I still much more personally fall on the angle of being a privacy advocate than mm-hmm. everybody should have everything attributable back to their individual IP address. Like the reality is we're getting much better at attribution than we were, say, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yep.
A perfect example of this is like China had been, you know, hacking in international and U.S. institutions for years and years and years, and they just mm-hmm. kept saying we weren't doing it.
Yeah.
The Mandy and APT one report just blew the doors off that, right? Like, here is all the evidence that we can show exactly these people inside your organization are doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
And attribution and that whole kind of counter-identification industry has become much more powerful in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
The schools and skills and techniques to, you know, figure out who's doing what and how to figure out who they are is way better than it used to be.
Yeah, 100%.
And the FBI is much better at, like, grabbing people out of third-party jurisdictions and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. drawing them in to beach holidays and then grabbing them off the beach.
That's
and stuff.
True. So, I love hearing those stories.
Yeah, but so I don't think that, like... I don't think it is worth it societally to us to mm-hmm. compromise everybody's desire for privacy in order to address this security concern. And like, I work in security. I love security. I believe security is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe that, you know, despite all the challenges and failings that we have in security, technology itself, despite vulnerabilities and breaches and, you know, loss of personal information, stuff like that, technology has dramatically improved our world in the last decade. Right. And so, you know, there's always kind of trade-offs and balances to be had here. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's worth, like, lock everything down, eliminate everybody's privacy, attribute everything to everyone in order to, you know, kind of attain perfect security. I think it's much better for us to accept some degree of risk and do what we can to improve our security along the way without necessarily throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
100%. And I just want to clarify that that is not what I'm suggesting. I'm just identifying that as one of the issues. But along those lines, I know you've had some thoughts along this concept that certain government and law enforcement agencies would like to open up a back door to encryption channels, which I find it's frightening that it's gotten this far as even a discussion.
Yeah,
I value privacy far more than the small problem that they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah,
trying to tackle.
Yeah, for regular security podcast listeners of like the Risky Business podcast, of course, they've been going off about the Australia legislation, especially.
Right.
The FBI have been, you know, it's interesting. If you're an active FBI director, you're always pushing for backdoors, and all the retired FBI directors are pushing for, actually, you know, encryption and security are a good thing.
Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, probably my favorite set of things that came out of some of the Snowden breaches and stuff like that were some of the stories that came out about the NSA implementing, you know, vulnerabilities into RSA encryption algorithms and stuff like that. So
mm-hmm.
going beyond just inserting a backdoor, but weakening the fundamental encryption algorithms that the softwares are built on and stuff like this.
Right.
And so I think there's, again, like it's desire of individuals to feel safe, and the people who are in the positions of, you know, public policy and government and stuff like that, saying our responsibility is to the safety of citizens. And so we're going to do everything that we can to enable that, and backdoors to encryption is the way that we're going to solve that.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's a much more nuanced conversation. It's like, yes, you can do that, but the reality is if you build in a backdoor, it's there for the attackers, and it's mm-hmm. not just the government that's going to get access. And everybody who works as an information professional understands this, right? Yeah. Like, there is no such thing as a backdoor that only law enforcement can use.
Right.
Right. It's like, if there's a backdoor, it's, you know, basically you don't really effectively have encryption anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so, who's going to oversee how that is used? I mean, how can we trust that a government organization or law enforcement will use it appropriately? We're just asked to take their word that they will.
Yeah, and I mean, a good example of that for us here locally is the state of privacy legislation with the BC government, where, mm-hmm. you know, there have been strong policies and requirements around not moving Canadian data, privacy data, south of the border because... Mm-hmm. We don't trust things like the FISA Act and stuff on how the U.S. government will choose to use, collect, and take advantage of their, you know, law enforcement backdoor access to information, right? And so, you know, this is the challenge that a lot of people brought up about the Australian legislation as well is, well, if we actually adhere to these laws, we pass them and we allow for backdoors into software, mm-hmm. basically people are going to stop trusting our software. Yeah. Right. In the same way, we don't trust the Chinese apps these days because mm-hmm. it's like, what? How do we know that the Chinese government aren't collecting all this information on our citizens? And so, right. you know, while we can think within this jurisdiction, it might be good for our citizens to have this backdoor to prevent a terrorist attack or, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to find child porn or whatever it is, you have to look at it in the larger context of, you know, we live in this world with multiple domains and jurisdictions, and we can't trust everybody or anybody. Mm-hmm. And so the better route is actually, you know, accept some of the law enforcement difficulty in getting into data, and data security and privacy is actually more important.
I agree. Perfectly said, Michael. I love that. Let's go back to Cobalt for a second. So let's talk about some of the clients who are getting it right and who maybe needs a little bit of a boost in terms of their security. And when I ask that question, I should sort of preface it. I love when we meet with clients that have very high-level, sophisticated IT teams, and yet they still recognize that they may have a gap. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of people that I love. They're very forward-thinking, and you seem to work with a lot of those kind of clients.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a diversity of clients. And it's mm-hmm. it's interesting, too, because it isn't the size of the company, right? Like, it's a culture thing.
Yeah.
And so I think the clients that get it right think about building a security culture and executing against a security culture mm-hmm. and recognizing that they're on a journey and there's an opportunity for improvement.
Yeah.
And they do that through education, development, awareness training, engaging 30-party experts like yourself, myself. Mm-hmm. You know, they are looking to say, I want to be better tomorrow than I am today.
Right.
I understand that I'm not perfect, but I'm going to try to improve. Mm-hmm. There are a tremendous number of organizations, unfortunately, who think about security only when it's a problem or think about it when it's hit in the press or when one of their colleagues has been attacked by ransomware.
Right.
And then they're kind of in the react mode, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God, this is an emergency. I need to deal with it now. Yeah. And then when it's not an emergency, they're not dealing with it.
Right.
And so there's a ton of organizations that look like that out there. So, you know, from a fundamental core approach and philosophy perspective, it's, how do you establish a culture,
right?
How do you establish a culture that is going to understand and accept where you are today because you can't be perfect mm-hmm. and figure out how to programmatically move yourself forward? And it's not always about spending money, right?
I agree. Yeah.
A lot of things that you can do to improve security are absolutely free, you know, options. Mm-hmm. When I do gap assessments for our clients, we usually prioritize things high, medium, low based on threat modeling, based on different control areas. And then we come up with cost estimates on, like, you know, there might be a third-party cost, like a piece of software you need to buy or something like that, or a firewall. But a lot of things are free, right? Mm-hmm. And typically, like, in a gap assessment, about a third of the things that we find are $0 cost and maybe half an hour worth of work, right? And so there's lots of little quick wins that can be grabbed along the way that help improve your stance.
Absolutely, yeah. I want to draw anybody who's listening now their attention, and hopefully they can visit the Cobalt website. And so it's Cobalt with a K.
Yep.
Cobalt.io.
Yeah.
You actually have a lot of, well, I don't know if a lot, but you have some free tools, some minimal cost tools that people can use to sort of assess their state.
Yeah.
Can you talk about those? Because they're wonderful tools.
Yeah. One of the ones I re-released recently, I'd done it when I was running Sky Northern, was a ransomware readiness assessment.
Right.
Probably the most common thing anybody in information security who is talking to a business owner these days mm-hmm. will hear is, am I ready for ransomware, right? I just had a colleague in a very similar industry who had a ransomware attack, and they ended up paying $500,000, or it shut down their business for 2 weeks. I'm afraid that this is going to happen to me.
Yeah.
And so I created this little self-assessment, which is like a three-page questionnaire, mm-hmm. you know, three questions, a bunch of, across a variety of different control areas where you can just go, you know, am I green or am I red,
yeah.
right? And like mm-hmm. start there, and then, you know, from there, get a feeling for, all right, if I'm green because I'm doing a lot of the right things, then this is probably not my primary risk.
Right.
If I'm red, then, you know, where are there opportunities for improvement? And in the questionnaire, you'll see there's mm-hmm. obvious things. It's like one of the things that's really important as it relates to ransomware, less so with other types of security attacks, is backup and restore.
Right.
Right. Like if you've got really good backup and restore, then generally if your endpoint's infected, then you can recover that in a timely fashion mm-hmm. and the impact to your business is lower.
Yeah.
Right. If you could have the best anti-malware protection in the world and crappy backup to restore, mm-hmm. something eventually is going to get by,
right.
at which point you're left holding the bag,
yeah.
right? And so
yeah.
understanding, you know, that in a security program it's well-rounded is a really important part for any
yeah.
assessment.
Absolutely. I've personally seen a lot of attacks, ransomware-style attacks, where the backup gets encrypted as well because
yes.
it's not sufficiently separated on the network, or it's not cloud-based or something. Or, you know, there's several redundant features that you can build into your network that prevent that from happening very easily.
Yeah, there's degrees of, you know, advancement in terms of the attackers as well.
Yeah.
Like some attackers, you know, they use ransomware as a tool, but they're actually doing a targeted attack,
mm-hmm.
and they will actually go after the cloud-based and online backups, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're a large organization, unfortunately, even though it's 2019, soon 2020, offline backups actually do still make a certain amount of sense.
Yeah.
You know, probably one of my favorite examples is, I think it was Maersk, one of the large
mm-hmm.
Ransomware attacks that occurred, took out all their domain controllers and, you know, shut down their business for quite a period of time. And
mm-hmm.
it was only because one of their domain controllers in Africa had happened to be offline at the time
right.
that they were able to recover at all.
Yeah.
Right. And so online is great. It's not necessarily going to save you. Another thing that's really important is, all right, so you've got an online backup and you're in Vancouver and your backup is in Toronto and it's time to do a restore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start restoring the data and you've got like a 1 gig internet pipe at your office and you have to restore 20 terabytes of data.
Yeah.
That's going to take you a long time, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not just, you know, do I have the backup, but how quickly can I actually recover and remediate
right.
when I need to? So
can
the backup provider spin me up a virtual instance? Can mm-hmm. they ship me disks, all this kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the same token,
yeah.
if you pay the ransom, it's going to take time to go through that decryption process. And
yep.
people think that they can just pay and get it back and up and running. It's not that simple.
Yeah, and again, like one of the things I'm really a big fan of is terms of like have a plan, have an incident response
mm-hmm.
plan. You know, when you're in the fire, you don't want to be going like, where's the fire alarm? Where's the
yeah.
exits? All this kind of stuff. You
Absolutely.
Know, when you're dealing with ransomware, you don't want to be going, do I pay? Do I not pay? You
yeah.
don't want to spend 3 days making that decision. You want
mm-hmm.
to know, all right, this is our policy. We pay. This is who's responsible for getting Bitcoins. This is whose budget it's
yeah.
coming out of. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And like a lot of organizations, they struggle through that process and it
mm-hmm.
goes from bad to worse to terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the impact is dramatically higher. And so,
yeah.
You know, your incident response plans are a fantastic tool to help
Thank you.
Reduce the impact of incidents,
mm-hmm.
not just kind of respond to the ones that are occurring.
Yeah. And part of the reason why I developed that program is because so many people waste so much valuable time just trying to figure out who to call
yep.
when it's going on.
Yep.
And then when they isolate that down to maybe two or three companies, now they go through the process of negotiating rates and figuring out who's a good fit to work with. And it just wastes enormous amounts of time. And then
yep.
when we show up on the scene, we're not really familiar with her. Then that,
yep.
that the company, we're taking more time there. So
yeah.
Having a plan is just, it makes sense.
Absolutely.
Right? So
And there's also a lot of value in having somebody that this is what they do, right?
Yeah.
Like they're the calm head in the storm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've sailed through a lot of storms in the past. They know what they're dealing with. They know, oh, this is a privacy breach and, you know, we should engage your legal team and,
yes.
you know, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's protected under, you know, client legal confidentiality rules and all this
yep.
kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
there's a lot of good reasons to
mm-hmm.
to have that beforehand. It's
yeah.
like business insurance or,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything else.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, if anybody's listening to this podcast, I think I mention it pretty much every episode that in Vancouver here, there's so many great people that work together, like you and Farshad and Christian Dominic and us. And And all these great people, they know their skill set and they know their specialty. And when something is beyond that scope, they call in a partner.
Yep.
And I just think we all work really, really well together to help our clients.
Yeah, I mean, we all have a common mission, which is like, you know, we want to make security better for our clients, mm-hmm. right? We want to help them be successful in their businesses.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons, going back to the origin stories of Cobalt and where we focused on these SaaS B2B companies, like most organizations actually don't want to buy or spend or invest in security other than like they know they have to. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons we started focusing on B2B and SaaS companies was they're actually, security for them is a business driver because mm-hmm. they're going out and they'll close a big deal with a Starbucks as an example.
Right.
And Starbucks will come to them with a 30-page document of security requirements and they haven't done those yet, right? And so a lot of, you know, what we're helping organizations through is not just the, how do I make sure that I'm preventing the security incident from ever happening, because a lot of companies will choose not to think about that proactively.
Yes.
But how do I help you win that deal by mm-hmm. being able to say yes to the security questions and addressing those things?
Absolutely.
Right? And so it's unfortunate, but it's a constant truism that, you know, compliance is one of the biggest drivers of security mm-hmm. and compliance to customer requirements is one of those sets.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Wonderful. How can people connect with you? So we've talked about the Cobalt website, but personally, you're on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. Twitter is where a lot of great security conversations happen as well. I do not have a podcast, but I love participating in them. But easily...
Somebody has to be guests.
Easily just michael@cobalt.io, okay. K-O-B-A-L-T.io.
Perfect. I encourage everybody to connect with you, and you can always, if you can't help directly, you're going to point them in the direction that's going to help them the best. Thank you for contributing all your content that you do. It's really helpful. And thanks for being a colleague and a friend of mine. I'm really thrilled that we professionally connected a little over a year ago now.
Actually. Yeah. So it's really exciting. Thanks for taking the time and sharing your audience. And hopefully some people learned some things today. And thanks again.
Yeah. Good fun. Thanks, Michael. Have a great day.
You too.